Welcome to episode 23 of Working Title Podcast. I'm your host, Joshua Paul Kane. Today I'm speaking with G.J. Koch, J.C. Koch, Gemma Chase, Anita Ensel, and A.E. Stanton. They're all the same talented and prolific Jenny Koch, author of the Alien Catherine Kitty Cat series, Necropolis Enforcement series, Martian Alliance Chronicles series, and the Alexander Outland series. Whew! We dive into how to create a series, or several, those pen names of hers, and what a writer should consider when creating them, and preparing your book for submission. Plus, she shares her secret for being a productive writer. Thank you to readers who submitted questions. Jenny answered every one. So hold on to your hats and enjoy. But first, this important message. In my writing life, my favorite time of year is October. That's when James River Writers holds its annual Writers Conference right here in Richmond, Virginia. Hundreds of attendees from across the country and even around the world come to this two-day event. Writers of all levels and backgrounds looking for a welcoming, friendly, inspiring, educational, and fun experience will find it at the JRW Conference. You can also sign up for one-on-one sessions with agents who are looking to build their lists. Registration is now open. Visit jamesriverwriters.org to learn more and to register. Hope you can make it, and if you do, come find me and say hello. Welcome, Jenny, to my podcast. I really appreciate you coming.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy you are having me, so to speak. That did not come out as smoothly as what I need to edit that. Hold on a second, because that's part of writing. Oh, Josh, thank you so much for having me. The honor is mine.
I can see the little red marks on the sentence.
Well, I mean, that's one of the things that I think a lot of authors, especially aspiring authors and the newer, lower on the how many words I've written scale, people forget that you can fix anything in post.
Right.
So editing is part of the writing process.
Oh,
if you don't learn to edit, you actually don't learn to write.
I heartily agree. I thought you could start with, when I initially met you, I knew of the Alien series, but I didn't know till later that was just one of several series you write. And I thought, could you really quickly just run down all these series that you're in the midst of writing and maybe a brief summary of each of them?
Sure. Okay. As I race over to my bibliography page on my website to make sure I don't forget something.
That's probably several screens long by now, I'm sure.
It kind of is, yeah. So it's one of those things that I'll be like, blah, 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 and then someone will say, well, what about this series? It's like, oh, yeah, that one. So, well, my main series, as you said, is the Alien Catherine Kitty Cat series from Daw Books, which is part of Penguin Random House. And in that, my heroine, Kitty, discovers that the Roswell rumors are true, but with a twist, the aliens are here to help us. And as a side benefit, they're all gorgeous. And the women, the female aliens, she nicknames the Dazzlers, are all sapiosexual. So to them, it's brains and brain capacity that matters. So as far as they're concerned, the sexiest person on the planet is Stephen Hawking. And in Kitty's universe, he's still alive. Because
okay.
I don't want to write the whole book of Dazzler Morning, basically. and that's a very fun series. And Kitty gets involved in the fight to protect the world and ends up saving the day with her knowledge of popular culture, comics, Hairspray, and rock and roll. So that's very fun. And then there's a kind of a spin-off short story series that I call the Alien Steampunk Universe. And the reason why that matters is book 16, which just released in February, is called Aliens Abroad. But book 17 that I am in writing right now, which comes out next February, is set in the steampunk universe. So those steampunk shorts actually matter in terms of they aren't just me having fun. They are me setting the stage for book 17. So that was fun. And then I have the Necropolis Enforcement Files series, and the first book in that series is The Nightbeat. And that is, the conceit is that the undead are not all evil. When you undie, if you are qualified to join the undead, you choose your god or your monster, and the gods and monsters are fighting on the side of right. Everybody's fighting against the Prince of Darkness, who is the ultimate evil, who is not Satan or Lucifer, who are in different roles. Satan works for Yahweh, for example. So, and that came in, and despite that intro, it's actually very funny. Victoria Wolf is an undercover policewoman who's also an undercover werewolf, and she works in Prosaic City Police Department protecting humans from the transference point, because Prosaic City is built right on top of Necropolis, which is a city of giant city of the undead. So if you like, you know, all the monsters, all the undead, they're all in this series somewhere along the line. And basically Victoria and her ragtag crew of smart-mouthed, sarcastic beings have to avert Armageddon.
Oh.
So, yeah. And so that's a very fun series. And I started that because I got very tired. Every one of our myths like this, vampires, werewolves, golem, you name it, they come out of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And we've just shoved religion aside. And I feel like that is doing a disservice, because that is their origin.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't buy the, well, you got bitten by a werewolf, so now you're evil. You got bitten by a vampire, so now you're an evil undead. You know, I'm sticking with the, you still get the choice. So, and it's very fun, and hilarity ensues.
Yeah.
Then I have the Martian Alliance Chronicles series, which is set in the far future, and that deals with yet another ragtag crew who are trying to save the galaxy from an evil family of, basically, space mafia, who have taken over and have systematically eradicated several races, and these people are hiding the true emperor of the galaxy, and so forth, and they're zipping about, conning people, saving the day, doing their thing, and that's also fun. And then I have several standalones as well as series. And the next one though would be the Alexander Outland series, and that's also set in the far future, where basically Napoleon Alexander Outland is the best pilot and one of the best smugglers and con men and things like that in the galaxy, and he really just wants to take the money and run, but events conspire to force him to have to save the day, or he and his crew aren't going to make it.
Oh, wow.
So that one's very fun. Then I have the New West series, which starts with when Josie comes home. And that is dystopian fiction set in the far future, but in an Old West setting. And hang on, there's more. wait, I think series-wise, there's only
interview.
One.
We might be.
I know, really. There's one more series, The Legend of Belladonna, which is only available in audiobook right now, and the first book in that is Natural Born Outlaws.
Okay.
So, and that is a novel series set in the Old West. About the world's, about the West's most infamous female outlaw.
So I'm not sure to be concerned. For
and
that.
I have standalones.
Do you have a mania that you can write so much?
It's a controlled form of schizophrenia, and I make it work for me. So
I can't even fathom how you do it. So.
We haven't even talked really about the standalones, of which I have a lot too, and short stories and anthologies and some collections and things like that. So I don't sleep as much as I'd like, for one. And I write under several different pen names so that I can change my voice, because I think your name is your promise to your readers.
Mm-hmm.
And so as Ginny Koch and G.J. Koch, I write funny science fiction and, well, anything, really. And J.C. Koch, I write horror. As A.E. Stanton is the Old West and the New West. So that's as Legend of Belladonna series is A.E. Stanton, as is the New West series. And then Gemma Chase, mostly paranormal with some fantasy and science fiction, and Anita Ensal, same thing, runs the gamut, but Gemma, that's my quirky goth girl side, you know, and Anita I think of as very peace-loving Bobby Sherman kind of thing. So yeah, but it allows me to, being funny really is a lot of work. You know, the dying is easy, comedy is hard line is very, very true. And so, you know, after I've written a long novel, because the Alien series novels are getting longer and longer, after I've written a long novel about... and having to make you laugh all the way through it, it's really nice just to get to kill something and not have to make you laugh. But I can't do that as Ginny Koch. I can't do that, however, as J.C. Koch or any of the other names, really. So that's one of the reasons. And then the other reason that I write under pen names, in addition to getting to change my voice, is that because the voice is changing, okay, if I wrote the New West series as Ginny Koch, and you just finished, you know, one of the Alien series books, or Alexander Outland, or Necropolis Enforcement, if I was a Nightbeat, right? And you just thought, that was just the most fun, right? Gosh, it was so funny, and it was fun, and now I'm going to pick up the New West. And there are a couple of jokes that the characters make that there's no laughs. You're going to be like, well, I hate this. This is no good. And now you won't read it, and you won't buy my book, because you weren't prepared for it. Okay, but if you see it's me writing as A.E. Stanton, you know, oh, A.E. Stanton does not have the sense of humor he is aware of. So you know it's going to be different, and you go in with a different expectation. And in the case, for example, of The Legend of Belladonna, Graphic Audio, who is the publisher on that, as far as they were concerned, they don't know who Ginny Koch is, because they don't have any of my books from the science fiction side. So to them, they didn't want to release it as Ginny Koch writing as A.E. Stanton, because that didn't matter to them. So, you know, those readers, or listeners in that sense, if they go looking for something else by A.E. Stanton, they'll find the New West series, which is right in the same wheelhouse. And then from there they can discover, oh, she writes other things too. But if you just dump somebody in with, you know, a voice change without giving them that kind of level set, they're not going to like it. They're going to dislike things. I have people who love the Alien series and don't enjoy Alexander Outland or Necropolis Enforcement Files. And that's fine. Everybody gets to like what they like. But that way I get to do more. Mm-hmm. And I get to do it reasonably safely.
What's your first series? Is that the Alien with Kitty? Is that the series?
The first novel that ever came out, yes, was Touched by an Alien, which is the first in the Alien series, yes. So not the first thing I ever wrote.
But with that series, you went with Ginny Koch. And then was that intentional? Did you at that point think about your name? Like, at what point did you think about having different names for different genres of your writing?
Way before. You know, the first thing published is not the first thing written for most of us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'd been writing for a good decade before I wrote. Things started happening pretty quickly. I sold a couple of humor pieces, and then I sold an Anita Ensal short story into an anthology, and then my agent sold Touched by an Alien and Alien Tango to Daw. And so Ginny Koch isn't my real name either. It's a pen name. And, you know, after 10 years of being out there, I mean, all you have to do, honestly, is look at the copyright on everyone's books. And there are some publishers who don't, and who put it in the copyright under my pen name, but most of them do not. That copyright's my real name, okay? And that's what my humor had originally published under. My decision way back when was whatever sold first got my real name. And that was my humor pieces, so that got my real name. And so while I was writing Touched by an Alien, it wasn't a voice I'd used before. It wasn't a style I'd really used before. And I realized it didn't really sound voice-wise like any other of my existing pen names that I was working with. And so I actually have a very long and, well, I guess it's not that long, involved story on how I picked that pen name. But I've been holding it in reserve. And so when it came time, Ginny Koch just fit this series and The Voice, and so that's where that went there. Now, originally, because I had no idea how much work being a publishing author was, I knew all about the business side and I knew all the stuff, but the meeting the deadlines when you have more than one, when you have them, when all of a sudden there's just, oh my, I have a short story there and a novella and I need an installment here and I've got this there, I had no idea what that was going to be like. Mm-hmm. So back in the blissful golden days before I had sold anything, I had this plan. I was going to be a different person for each book, right? You know, Anita would dress in caftans with long flowing scarves. A.E., you know, maybe I'd get a male actor to pretend to be, right? I mean, just elaborate stuff that you do when you have no concept what's really coming. Well, I mentioned that Anita Ensel short story, right? So mm-hmm. That's about my fourth sale, my first short story sale into an anthology. And the publisher is so excited to discover that I've also sold a two-book deal because they happened very close together, and it was really nice publisher, Posick. Unfortunately, they shuttered, but they're really nice people, and they are so excited. So they did an interview with me, right? Mm-hmm. And we're talking about all things, and literally, so this is like the first interview I'm doing as a published author. And it comes out, and the first line is Phoenix resident Jeannie Cook is writing as both Ginny Gosch and Anita Ensel. I'm like, well, we're not hiding anything, are we? And I just wrote it all off, and thank goodness, because the mere idea of trying to be seven different people is well, that's the level of crazy going on in here, yeah, right? But at the same time, it's just the effort to do that. It's like you just got to be you, right? You've got to be the you that is on with your fans and with people at signings and things like that. And I'm basically me, only a little bit, even more. Mm-hmm. But I couldn't. I can't even imagine switching. Excuse me. Oh, I'm signing six different things by six of my names. I've got to change clothes. Hold on.
Literally different hats. Many hats.
Right. Let me sling a different hat on, right, so you can all see the dead weasel on my head from the hat that's been on for the last hour. Right. Yeah. So that quickly disabused me of the romance of the notion. It is strictly a business reason why I'm using pen names. For those people, there are people, for example, let's say you are a kindergarten teacher, mm-hmm. and you're writing children's, but you're also writing erotica, you'd better have a pen name that distances you, because sure. people just cannot yes. handle it, okay? Sure. So I'm not in that situation, but I do have a lot of friends who are, and so there are business and there are personal safety reasons, you know, if you're unfortunate enough to get weirdos, you know, it's really nice that they don't know who you really are and mm-hmm. things like that. But my reasons are all strictly business.
Honestly. Is there a way to pick a pen name that's suited to a genre? Do people do that?
No. People try. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like, I really would like to pick the pen name J.K. Rowling, but they won't let me do it. J.K. Rowling writing is Ginny Koch. I mean, you know, she might want to check, though, and that would be a problem. But, no, you kind of have to go with it. I have never had a pen name changed yet, and I want to stress yet, because you never know. There are business reasons to use a different pen name if you had a series that tanked. Mm-hmm. Okay. The publishers may be very willing to give you another try, but they're not going to give that name another try.
Right.
So you have to change it. Or your name is J.K. Rowling, and you can't use that because, oh, my God, right?
Sure.
You need to change it. Okay, and so on. Or there's another person with your first name that sounds a lot like, and their last name is a lot like yours. You can keep the first name, but you need to change the last name, you know, that kind of thing. For women, a lot of folks use, you know, you use your middle name, you use your maiden name if you're married, you use, you know, grandma's last name. There's lots of ways to do it. and you can make names up. Anita Enthal is made up. Okay, mm-hmm. Enthal is a made up name, completely, which is a private joke between me and my friend Phyllis Heeman, who is the friend that gave me permission to write, which I needed. Not everybody does, but I needed the permission to write. I didn't need the permission to stink on ice, but I've given that to a lot of people because people seem to think that they're going to just, the first thing they're going to write is brilliant, and when it isn't, they're all distraught, right? It's like, no, you're going to stink for a long time. So embrace it and just keep writing until you don't stink anymore. I knew that, but I really didn't feel like I had the right to write, and Phyllis said, oh, yes, you do. So that name is a joke between her and me, but that's a you get to find out how that came about at a bar. That's not for a podcast.
Okay. Well, thank you. One more question on the
sure.
different names. How do you keep it all straight as far as social media goes? Or you mentioned conferences. That's easier.
I gave up.
Oh, you gave up.
I gave up. I originally, oh my God, I was going to have a way. I have actually sites for all these names. They're attached to my main site. Mm-hmm. I just gave up, and it's just Jenny Koch writing as. So other than a graphic audio, everything else is Jenny. If it's not Jenny Koch, it's Jenny Koch writing as. Just because it's just easier. I couldn't handle the under my personal name and under Jenny Koch.
Mm-hmm.
And I keep, you know, hinting to those people who are still expecting me to answer their stuff over at my personal stuff. It's like, I come on here once a quarter, and that's it. If you want to talk to me, you better friend me as Jenny Koch, because that's the only way you're going to see me on social media. But it's just so much work.
Sure.
You know, and social media is great. It allows you to really interact with fans. It allows you to interact with other authors. And I talk to, you know, my wonderful publicist at Penguin Random House. I'll talk to her on social media. I talk to my assistants on social media. But in order to keep that up, that's too frenetic. I don't have any problem keeping the pen names in my mind because I see them as different people in my mind. I'm not joking about that controlled form of schizophrenia. And the positive side of Split, you know. But, like, Jenny Koch, G.J. Koch is Jenny Koch's twin brother, as far as I'm concerned. And J.C. Koch is their funky, weird uncle. Okay, so that's how I keep the Koch name started. Anita Enthal is married to A.E. Stanton. Like I said, I see her as this flowery, she's related to the Koches in some way, and she's, you know, wears the caftans, and then she's very peace and love and all this stuff, and she's married to this gruff old guy who wears a cowboy hat and wants to ride horses and motorcycles, right? And then Gemma Chase, like I said, is a goth girl who's, you know, mooning about, doing her thing, and writing about, you know, blood and chocolate, basically.
Wonderful combination.
So, yeah, so, and I have other names that aren't out yet, okay? Oh, we won't talk about that. But everybody's, I related everybody to each other, and I see them in that sense as, you know, these entities. So it's, I put on the skin,
right.
You know, or I ask them to sidle on over and mention to me what it is that they would like me to write right now.
But the family reunion would be difficult to arrange for them all.
It's really easy, actually. I just, you know, close my eyes, relax, and they're all there. Yeah, including the ones I haven't named who were like, when are you finishing my book? Why isn't my book out?
Do you use different photos or the same photo for every one of your...
I use some different photos, they're all still me. I use some different photos just because I happen to have them, and it's kind of fun that way. It's not the same picture everywhere. You can say, ooh, that one's cute, or, oh, that's not my favorite, or whatever. But, you know, I have my favorites. The one I gave you is my favorite. Right. Really, it's just more, I've used that photo 16 times. Maybe I should use this one a few times, and that's really the only reason.
Okay. Well, I know I have a lot of reader questions. Hopefully I'll get to them all. But before I get to any of them, I just wanted to go back to writing a series. Your first series, did you always have envisioned it as a series? And if so, how did you prepare for that?
I see almost everything in series.
Okay.
The way my mind works, let me say for a moment, I don't outline. I am an extreme, in fact, I didn't write for 20 years because I heard from a teacher who I knew at 15 was an idiot, but I still believed everything she said. She was an idiot, and I knew it, and yet when she said the only way you can write is to outline, I believed her. And outlining works great for term papers, and it's wonderful for business proposals, and I used it for both of those. But when it comes to creative writing, there is no one right way. If you're an outliner, awesome, more power to you, but I, as it turns out, am not. If I know everything that's going to happen, I have no interest in writing the story, long or short. So I didn't realize that until finally the voices in my head got so loud and so demanding that I finally just sat down to shut and wrote to shut them up. And I looked up, you know, 8 hours later at 200 pages, I typed very fast. And I was not editing. I was just writing because it didn't matter, right? I was just getting out there. And literally, I've never looked back. But it took that. Some people seem so, I mean, ultimately, as you get farther in your career, you have to learn how to do it all. Work for hire usually tends to demand an outline. I've been very fortunate in the work for hire that I've done. They have accepted what I consider like the back cover blurb for the story. But others won't. They want a full outline. It's sort of like, yeah, let's not ask for that anytime soon, because I can write the story and then do the synopsis from it faster than I can do an outline and then write a story. But you do have to learn how to do these things. Scene sewing, you know, you write the scenes as they come to you, and then once you've written them, you sew them into the right order.
That's
and connect
I do,
them
yeah.
as they should be. Yeah. Yeah, okay. I mean, really, the nice thing about scene sewing is as soon as you start getting edits from editors, you have to do it anyway. You know, I had in Alien and the Family, book three, my editor wanted more. She wanted a paparazzi character, and she wanted some more stuff, and so I had to go in and add this stuff in and make it look seamless, and I learned a lot. So I see almost everything in series. It's the rare thing that I see as a standalone, and even the standalones, a lot of them could easily turn into series or will turn into series when I have time. There are a couple, though, A Cup of Joe, which is by me writing Zanita Ensal, and Plush Life, which is me writing as Ginny Koch. A Cup of Joe is dystopian science fiction, and Plush Life is romantic suspense. Those two, there won't be a sequel to A Cup of Joe, and I could do a sequel to Plush Life. People would really have to beg me for it. Not that I loved the characters and I loved writing the book, but it just, I saw it as a standalone. I know how I could do it with sequels, but it's not, I would rather write the next Alexander Outland, the next Necropolis Enforcement Files, Martian Files, Kitty, anything, you know. I'm not looking there. There are some shorts, however, that definitely I know I will write more in, some because of fan requests of please, please, please more here, and some just because I know they're more adventures, I have to get time to get to them. But in terms of series, like I said, for the most part, I see everything in series. If a character has a speaking line in anything I've written, I can, if asked, tell you everything about that character.
Oh, wow.
Okay, from birth to death. Now, a lot of times, if someone asks, it helps me expand the character, okay? But usually, I already know this stuff. And so it's just there. It's just there in the back of my head. So I didn't plan a series out. It came out, okay? Because that's how everything comes out, okay? However, you do actually have to plan, as I discovered, because you have to be preparing yourself and your readers, and that's one of the great things. Sheila Gilbert is my editor at Dawn. She is just fabulous. She's finally won a Hugo, I think it was last year. Well-deserved. She's deserved one, you know, for decades, right? She is really good. And you learn so much from a good editor at a good house. You really do. And one of the things was she was asking me questions when we were editing Touched by an Alien. And she's like, okay, here's why I'm asking this. It's because this is a series. Okay, you already have the first four books written. If all goes well, there's going to be more. You know, cough, cough, book 16 just came out in February. And we need to know where this is going. Because if that character is important, that character can't just show up in book two. There has to be some essence of that character, of how this stuff has to work. So she really, really helped me figure out how to do that. Now, I, of course, one of the things, if you're smart, you take what you've learned from your editor and you apply it to everything, whether that editor is working on it or not.
Let's stay on that. What were some things she suggested? How do you lay in your characters for the long term? What are some
you
got to
think about it. You got to think about it. Who's important? Where?
Mm-hmm.
I think one of the best examples of something she did. So we're going through and in Touched by an Alien, right at the start. Okay, Kitty sees a super being form in front of her and she kills it and she's on the news and everything else. And Sheila says it seems like she doesn't live in the real world. And I said, what do you mean? And she's like, the only people who call her are her parents. So does she have no friends?
Mm-hmm.
Does she have no work things? I'm like, oh, well. And I start telling her all about the friends, all of whom are coming in later.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, well, we need to see that now. We don't have to see them, but we need to know they exist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you need to show that she has people that care about her beyond this and that she's not, you know, some weirdo walking. She was going back to work. Surely the people at work want to know what's happened, right? So...
office gossip for sure.
Right, exactly. So from that, it expanded out. It's like, so we talked about all the characters that many of them I already knew because, remember, I'd written book four. But even if I hadn't, I was seeing several books ahead because
mm-hmm.
That's how I write. While I'm writing this book, I can definitely see the next one, and I can see sometimes like two or three ahead on what's going to happen. And so you have to set up this book so those books work out. So it just means you leave little clues and you make sure that you're doing something right. And then there's also the author convenience. You can't have a character who knows everything in Chapter 2 and knows nothing in Chapter 3 because it's really convenient for them to know everything in 2, but it's really not convenient. It's more dramatic if they know nothing in 3, right? We all do it. We all do it until we're caught and called on it. And I was doing that, and so we fixed that. Now I try to make sure, you know, a lot of it's just applying what's already happened. Okay, I have to introduce these characters. I have to make sure there's this. I have to make sure there's that. I have to leave clues. I have to go back and see what clues I've left. You know, did I leave enough, or is this going to come out of right field, and therefore do I need to leave more? You know, that kind of stuff. So there's a lot of planning, none of which I write down.
Oh, okay.
So I just am not a writer downer. I'll write little notes to myself,
uh-huh.
not a lot, and I'm trying to get them all into one book so it's not these scattered pieces of paper.
Oh, yeah.
But
it's like herding cats, right? You know, like all the...
Yes, it's a lot easier said than done.
Right.
But I just keep it in my head. Yeah, this time I'll be more organized. You know, and then what I think people don't realize is how much research goes in. I mean, all of my series are either science fiction on the soft side or fantasy. Most of the stuff, you know, it's all made up, right?
Right. Sure.
But, like, I had to stop and look at what's the name of that cap. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And the cap I had to look up is, what is it? I don't know. Is a garrison or forage cap.
Okay.
Like what they wear in the Marines. Okay,
what
they're wearing, the enlisted men are wearing. I didn't know that, and I had to make sure I had the right terminology because Kitty has to drop that as part of a description and move on. She can't describe that hat. Okay, there's no reason to describe it if it
mm-hmm.
has a name,
right?
I say ridiculous amounts of why does this matter description by knowing the name, but I had to look that up. Well, I had to stop writing and look it up. So, you know, if you're doing other things, a tremendous amount of research goes in, and a lot of people don't necessarily know. And, you know, like every other author on the planet, I'm certain I'm on a watch list because for Alien Research, which is book 8, a very big portion of the book takes place at Guantanamo. I had Google Maps drill down on Guantanamo as close as you can get for like 6 months. And I'm just like, please, NSA, don't come and take me away in the night. It's just for a book. So that was fun.
Okay.
But everybody and other people are different, by the way, in how they do it. Some people have these gigantic the timelines built out for their worlds for hundreds of years, and that's fine too. It's got to be what works for you.
First question from a reader, Ben. He was a little long, so let me try to summarize. But he says you're one of the most prolific writers out there, multiple styles and genres. Do you write linearly, that is, book, one book to the next book, or do you switch between books as you're writing both? And how do you keep your writing style so distinctly different?
That's a great question.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks, Ben. That's a great question. Basically, I do not jump ahead when I'm writing the series. So I'm writing book 17. I'm not jumping ahead to 18. Book 17 is due. It has to get my focus. Depending on where I am in terms of deadline, however, I will bounce from one series to another. So the third installment for The New West, I need to get that done. So that's A.E. Stanton, completely different voice. So I can bound over there when I'm really stuck and do a little bit there so that it allows me to sound different and do different. And then while the Jenny Koch side is thinking on how to run Kitty, right?
Mm-hmm.
When in the olden days, I literally would be writing on four different books and four different series at the same time, somewhere, usually four, okay? And as soon as I'd get stuck on one, I'd move to the next one, and I'd write on it, and I'd move to it, and stuck there, moved, and I'd just cycle around, because it kept me writing, and it kept me going. With deadlines, it's really difficult to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when I know I'm coming up, and I am far from done, I got to be knuckling down. But at the same time, I will still also have, like, short stories due. One of the positives on that is it gives me that time, that compressed time of, okay, I'm going to take these 3 days and I don't care what it costs me, I'm getting this short story out. Short stories, by the way, for me, are harder to write than novels.
Oh, wow.
Everybody has a natural length that they write to. I happen to be a natural novelist, okay? Some of my friends are natural novella writers, okay? Some are natural short story writers. I am not a natural short story writer, so even though I can do it, it takes way more focus and concentration, and the right idea has to spark in the right way and then zoom, right? Once it does, I can get it done very quickly. So basically I have a short story that's due, and I'm noodling on that because the whole hope is that while I'm at San Diego Comic Con when this airs, I will already have been back from – sorry, spoiler alert, we're recording this in the past. I hope we didn't blow any. I hope I did not disappoint any of your listeners in some dramatic fashion. But for when we're recording this, I go to San Diego Comic-Con next week, and I'm hoping to write the short story in my downtime there, such as it is, because it's going to force me to do it, right? It's like, there you go. And then I get Kitty can get my full attention to finish up once I'm back. So it's sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. I mean, and I think one of the things that was very important for me was the realization, which came early, because the only reason I started writing was I started linearly. I wrote a title and I started with the first line and I just kept going and realized, oh, this is how I write. Okay, so people get very hung up on, well, this is the only way to do it. I mean, every writing book, you have to do it my way. Why? Because if I say, whatever works, that's a very short thing, and nobody's going to pay me, $24 in hardback to buy that and hold that and talk about it, how brilliant it is. But I can go into any writing book and show you examples of how everything they're saying is cut in stone, doesn't actually work for somebody else who is successful.
The thing is, it's
not theory. If Stephen King says this is how to write, what Stephen King's saying is this is how I write, and it's been hella successful for me.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, but that doesn't mean it's going to be successful for you.
Right.
Okay, and everybody says it as this is cut in stone and there's the only way, and that's not true. There's only one rule that is inviolate, and that is money flows to the author, never pay to play, ever. Okay, someone charging you to publish your book is a ripoff artist. Mm-hmm. Publishers pay you, not the other way around. Okay, and now the only place where it's a little different is when you're self-publishing, yes, you should be paying, if you're not good at it yourself, and I mean really good at it, you should be paying someone. However, you'd better have checked that person, okay, and had them give, you know, tested them on a chapter and seen how, I mean, I do a whole lecture on how to to be sure you're being properly edited. Which we're not going to do here because it's an hour.
Another time.
You will have to pay for good cover art. Please, God, pay for good cover art. Okay. But that's it. But that's your self-publishing. So you're the publisher. Those are things publishers pay for.
Right.
So when you are self-publishing, those are legitimate costs. However, if you are going anything that even remotely sounds traditional, in other words, anything that is not self-publishing, you shouldn't be paying anything. And in this day and age, unless you really know what you're doing, I have friends who do Kickstarters both for comic collections and for anthologies and books. And, yes, they will go out to printers and hire them, but they know what they're doing. If a publisher says, oh, and it's only $10,000 for 100 copies, you need to run in the other direction.
Okay, good.
Okay, you buy copies at anywhere from 40% to 65% to 75% off, depending on your publisher. As an author, you don't pay cover price, and you don't pay to have it printed. So that is the only inviolate law. Money flows to the author. The only other one that matters is that grammar, spelling, punctuation, syntax, and word usage all matter, especially to agents and editors.
Right, right.
And everything else, do whatever works. Right. Now, I'm not saying, oh, you typed out, you barfed a book out onto the page, you wrote the end, and you want us all to clap while you toss it up self-published with a terrible cover and no editing, and we're supposed to love your brilliant prose because, gosh, you wrote it. No. No, remember I mentioned editing? Yeah, very important. You don't edit, you don't allow yourself to be edited, you're not really an author. What you are is somebody with a ridiculously large ego who probably should find another career.
Yeah, I know some.
Okay.
Not personally, but I know of some also.
We all know. Yeah. We all know them. I know some personally. I know many personally, but not anymore. But yeah. So So don't be that basically don't be that person.
Yeah.
Do it your way, but don't be that person.
Now you seem to be very busy with writing, and Tom asks, you know, for a new author, you know, what would you recommend for balancing, you know, work life with a family, you know, kids, spouse, dog, etc.
I have one very simple thing. No.
He asked if it becomes different once you're published. Unpublished author becoming a published author, does that work-life balance change?
Yes, in some ways. Frankly, you'll probably balance better once you're published because when you're in that throw of, I'm an author, I'm writing, you tend to shut everything else out. But I will give you the secret, and I do this lecture too, and I have to do the lecture because people don't want to believe me. Here's the line. It's one sentence. You want to know how to become more productive? Ready? Hope everybody's listening very closely. Turn off the television.
Oh, yeah.
Every time I say that, I normally, if I'm doing a speaking, I have someone with me, an assistant, a friend, whatever. And I always say, oh, you want to be at the front of the room and turned around when I say this. The looks of panic and horror on people's faces. And they immediately start, I'm like, oh, no, I don't want to hear your excuses. Oh, you have to, no. Unless you wrote it, you acted in it, you are in part of the production, or they are paying you to watch. You don't need it. Television is the most inactive of all our entertainments. It it makes us vegetables and it gives us nothing back. Don't get me wrong, I've been watching the World Cup, okay? Vive la France! I hope they win, but because this is going to come out, you know, and it's probably going to be Croatia forever, but, you know, whatever. I'm hoping it's Vive la France. So, but when you sit down and give hours and hours and hours to the television, it gives you nothing back. And I've heard I'm learning plotting. No, you're not, because unless you're screenwriting and you immediately, as soon as you watch an hour, get up and go take what you learned and apply it, you're not learning anything, because how television works is not the same as how books work.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And a whole lot of other things. And frankly, you want to do that? One episode, plenty, you're done. Ba-doop, right? No, but we watch hours and hours, and it steals all your time.
Yeah.
All of it. Mm-hmm. You want to be productive, you want to write a million words, you want to do all this other stuff, you want to get all that stuff out, turn the television off, and do not turn it back on. Oh, I have to watch the news. No, you don't. If it's anything important, people are going to tell you. Okay, if it's a big deal, people are going to tell you. And if it isn't, then you didn't need to know about it. Period. Okay, turn off the negativity, turn off all that stuff. Facebook is pretty bad, and people go, well, you're on Facebook all the time. No, the tab is up. I keep like 200 tabs open on my browser.
I have coworkers.
We did mention all the names. We did mention all the names, right? And there's research, and I'm going to sub that story maybe if I get around to it, and that needs to go into my newsletter, so I'll forget about it if the tab isn't up. Okay. I keep Facebook up because my daughter will ping me on that, my critique partner will ping me on that, and that's part of how fans can talk to me. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But if I'm busy, I'm just like, la, 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 I don't see you. You know, my assistants talk to me that way. So it's like, yeah, it looks like I'm there because I moved the mouse, right? But I'm not there all the time. Facebook is also a horrific time suck. But nothing's worse than television. They aren't your shows. Again, you didn't write them, you didn't act in them, you didn't do anything, and you're not getting any money. They aren't your shows, any more than it's your team.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, if France wins, I get nothing other than a happy feeling that my favorite soccer player got to win, right? Mm-hmm. Olivier Giroud forever. But it's not, other than relaxation and enjoyment, it doesn't do anything for my actual career.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to have one, you have to be able to manage your time. And we all have times that are awful. Okay, you and I talked about this before we started recording, but we just moved. We're originally from Southern California. We lived the last 22 years in Phoenix. And in December, we had to move to Atlanta, which is a really nice town, lovely people. But it's a huge weather shock for us because, yeah, rains a lot here. And we are not used to that wet stuff falling out of the sky. And we're having to force ourselves to do things. So it's been very it's still kicking my butt. Okay, the move was exhausting. Starting at the end of 2016 and all of 2017 was a year in trauma for my family, just deaths and divorces and all these other things. And sorry, I didn't get to hear one of the dogs barking in the background. And all that jazz. But it was definitely something that we had to change my production schedule. Normally I was 2 books a year on the Alien series, and we've had to change that. Aliens Abroad was supposed to have come out in December. We made it for February just barely. And Aliens Like Us is coming in February next year because I just could not do it.
Mm-hmm.
And, after it's book 17, y'all are going to have to just learn some patience. And I can't get caught up if I'm getting more and more, and I have. For the last 3-4 years, I'm just getting more and more behind. And if you don't get to hit the reset button somewhere, you're not going to be able to survive. And it was really, really kicking my butt. So things like that, life is going to interfere. Okay, but the thing is that if you take all the time you're watching television and apply it to your writing, all of a sudden you've got time. People say, I don't have any time. I have Amber Scott is a friend of mine, and she her first books, her children were toddlers, mm-hmm. and she literally trained herself. She would get 5 minutes, and she would just literally fling herself over to her work in progress and write.
Wow.
There was no excuse. There was no this. She got 15 minutes, she wrote. She wrote, like, I don't know, 5 or 6 books that way. So if Amber can do that with Tiny Tots, okay,
anyway,
you all can do that without Tiny Tots or even with them. Okay, there's always time. And for it's like exercising. If you really want to do it, get up early or stay late. Stay late. Carve out that time. It's the same thing. You know, if it's important, you've got to carve the time out for it. And television is the least important thing you're going to do in your day, the very least. There is nothing less important. Reading, by the way, is one of the most active entertainments because you have to actually, your brain's making a movie in your head.
Right.
Listening is fine because you can listen and do other things. Okay, which is why audiobooks are, you know, why I listen to music while I'm writing, because it goes in and it helps me, but I don't have to consciously listen to it. It's there, but I get to do other things as well. But television, you have to sit, you have to pay attention, and it's just, you know, the drool's coming out of our mouths. And that, turn off the television. And I will tell you that everybody who listens to this, 99% of them are going to make excuses for why I don't understand their particular situation and how Game of Thrones just can't survive without them watching. Okay, there's going to be some reason that they've got. And I will tell you that those people are also going to complain that they don't have enough time to write.
Right.
And like I said, every time I do this lecture, the looks on people's face, the terror. Turn off the television. My God, no, woman! What madness is this you speak of? You know, they would be more if I told them they had to sacrifice their firstborn. They would look less horrified.
Well, you make time for what's important. So.
Yes, the people don't realize that the time that they're making time, they've turned those TV shows into something important, and they're not. Again, you're writing them. If you're writing for television and you legit have a reason, sure. But, you know, even so, I mean, I will tell you, there is one series that I've told my editor that when I'm really, really feeling like my tank is just completely dry, I go back and I watch Burn Notice.
Burn Notice. Because it was a good show. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and those are pretty much like my books. They work like my books. So I don't have to watch all of Burn Notice. I just need to
like
watch
Bruce
a show
Campbell.
Or two. No, I love Bruce Campbell. But I think it's un-American to not love Bruce Campbell, isn't it? Right? Isn't it somewhere in the Constitution? And you must love Bruce Campbell. But I will watch a couple shows, and all of a sudden it's like, oh, yes, right about at that point, this has to happen. Ah, yes, that's where they're throwing the romance, the extra romance in, right? And all that kind of thing. But I don't have to watch all, 7 seasons of Burn Notice to refill my tank.
Right.
1 or 2 episodes, probably going to do it.
Probably good.
So, you know, again, if you need to find the one show that helps inspire you, great. But again, you should be spending more time on writing and worrying about that than the television show that's going to help you when you're stuck. So.
Uncle Dragon asks, what is your writing process like?
Oh, my God.
Do you have a routine? Do you have a place that you write in?
I have a downstairs office and an upstairs office.
Oh, wow.
So that, because I have cats who don't like me downstairs when it's nighttime.
Oh,
they want me upstairs. The dogs are upstairs already in bed, but the cats want me upstairs. They do not like it when I'm downstairs, so I'm upstairs at night, sometimes in the day as well. I am definitely in front of the computer. I don't write by hand. My process is really what I described earlier. I sit down and I just start writing. You know, I mean, many times I'll reread the last stuff. That helps me a lot. I mean, Hemingway used to, I think, stop in the middle of a sentence because then, you know, we had to write the next. I tried that. I could not remember what it was I was writing. So that didn't work for me. So what I do instead is I usually leave myself right at the start of an action scene.
Mm-hmm.
Because then it's like, ooh, I want to get to that and do that because I'm a very action and dialogue-driven author. So if I'm leaving myself right at the start of action, then awesome. I'm excited to get to it. In the middle of the sentence, I'm going to spend, I spent an hour once trying to remember what the sentence was, and I was like, that this was not working, and I never did that again. So it just did not work. And it, like, worked for me once, and I was all excited, and it never worked again. So, you know, try things out. I'm not saying don't try that out, because for some people that works really, really well. Just for me, it was like, huh, this sentence could go, like, 12 different ways. I wonder what way I wanted it to go last night when words were flowing and I was brilliant, right? This morning, in the light of day, I'm brilliant right up into this line, and now I don't know what I'm doing. So, yeah, I don't do that anymore. But mostly, yeah, mostly it's sit down and start writing. I need to have music on, rock music. Like, right now I'm listening to Fall Out Boy. And I tend to have – I hit songs that are on repeat a lot. Because for me, it's just, there's a combination of what the lyrics and the music are that it helps me get writing. The last 50,000 words of Alien Tango, for example, I listened to one song and one song only, and that was the 69 Eyes, Perfect Skin. Mm-hmm. And that book, I wrote those last 50,000 words in a week because of that song. And you going, wow, why don't you listen to that song all the time? Because it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work on anything else. Okay, I got to find a different song that does that. Right? My husband was like, I used to love that song, and now I never want to hear it again because it's just, I heard it for a week straight. So that's really more of my process. Beverages help, alcohol in particular. But really, beverages are good, and pictures of good-looking leading men because I'm extremely shallow.
Mark asked, you referenced pop culture, like Dennis Miller. What role does your knowledge of pop culture play in developing your storyline?
Okay, read the question again.
Oh, Mark asked, what role does your knowledge of pop culture play in developing your storyline?
Ah, okay. And it sounded like there was more example in there, and I lost
He said that. He said you remind him of Dennis Miller, like, you know, in his comedy.
Oh, that was a compliment. Thank you.
Yeah,
completely. It was like, I am not sure what that's. I think so too, but I didn't get mm-hmm. that whole. It garbled from my ears.
I have
no idea what that was. No, that's okay. Pop culture plays a huge role, particularly in the Alien series. Kitty is a huge pop culture, child of pop culture, a huge pop culture junkie. And I have Jeff Martini, who is our main alien, and who, you know, it's book 16. Spoiler alert, things have happened since book one. So if you haven't started the series yet, sorry if I'm ruining for you, but Jeff and Kitty get married, have a family, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And Jeff is an old TV shows, schlocky TV shows junkie. So he, like, loves watching the Love Boat reruns and Fantasy Island and all of that kind of stuff. The aliens, the main aliens on Earth are the Aces, because they come from one of the planets in the Alpha Centauri system. And there's actually a larger reason for why they call themselves Aces that you find out as the series goes on. But they don't really watch science fiction. And Kitty's joke is that that's because it's too much like watching documentaries.
Ah, I see.
So no, she uses science fiction all the time. You know, the Star Wars, Star Trek get a lot of shout-outs. So do a lot of other things. Anything I like or hate, and frankly from a pop culture standpoint, will work its way in there because Kitty – her dad likes old movies, so she's seen all this. So Kitty has this very wide pop culture experience, and she's hugely into rock and roll. Her favorite band in the world is Aerosmith, and she, you know, she relates a lot. Yeah, I love the best. Kitty and I share that. So she relates a lot of things to music and everything else. And as the series goes on, she's getting musical cues from somebody who's trying to help her out. And I'm not going to say anymore because that actually is a big spoiler in the series. So pop culture is very huge. It's huge for Kitty. I use it in other series as well, but like the Alexander Outland series and the Martian Alliance Chronicles, those are far future. Their version of pop culture doesn't matter. And in Martian Alliance Chronicles, they're in a system full of war, so they're not exactly, you know, yucking it up about the latest sitcom. And in Alexander Outland, I just have more fun with the people on the planets that Nap and his crew go to than anything pop culturally. I mean, each planet gets a little discussion about when they're there, about what their big things are. So I get to deal with that form of pop culture there. But in the stuff that is contemporary, I'll always have some kind of pop culture reference in there.
What are concerns you might have to, like, for a writer who has pop culture references in their book, are there pitfalls you might fall into where, legally speaking, things that you can say, like, can you mention a real life person? How much of a song lyric can you use? Things like that.
Almost none. Yes, there are pitfalls. There are pitfalls legally, and there are pitfalls from a reader's standpoint. So let's do the legal first. We'll get back to the pitfalls from the writing reader's standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, you have to be very careful if you're using real person, but I've used real people all the way through. I think it depends on how you're using them in a lot of cases, but as we discover in book 3 that it looks like, yeah, I think there's a multiverse out there, and we discover in book 10 for certain that there is one, and that Kitty's universe is not ours.
Uh-huh.
Okay, which is the first time you discover that. Again, spoiler alert for the series, we're in book, you know, I'm writing 17, sorry, okay? But that means I can, for example, like I said earlier, I can keep Stephen Hawking alive in Kitty's world.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, he's passed away in ours, but he's alive in hers. And so I can do those things. And I just, if I'm using a real person, if they're an evil, horrible person, like Kitty's not going to say anything good about Hitler, right?
Right,
and
right,
if Hitler comes up, he's not going to be a positive thing. But if she's mentioning, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson or the guys from Tears for Fears or Aerosmith or whatever, all of those portrayals, such as they are all very positive. So it's sort of like, you know, I can replace you with another band if that bothers you, that, you know, Kitty thinks you're the greatest thing since sliced bread. But it's not. There's also, when somebody is that public a figure, there's a fair usage. Like, you can use brands, you know.
Right.
You don't have to call it a soda pop. You can call it a Coca-Cola.
Right.
Okay. And celebrities are in that kind of that level. So you have to be careful. You know, if you've decided that what you want to do is choose, you know, Justin Bieber, and he's going to be your evil supervillain, you might have a problem.
Okay.
If you painted somebody who sounds a lot like Justin Bieber, for example, there is somebody, there's a character in book 15 who comes in. It needs to be somebody in Hollywood. It needs to be a big Hollywood guy. But I didn't want to use somebody because he actually is, it's more than a passing, it's more than, oh, I saw this guy on stage, or, oh, he's dreamy. It's this guy's interacting with Kitty and other characters. So instead of saying it's George Clooney, I gave him a different name and said he's the new George Clooney. Okay? So that's how you get around things like that. In terms of song lyrics, you can't use anything about a line. Okay? I think the first two lines, if it's not a really short song, and beyond that, it's theft. And we don't want people stealing our work. We shouldn't steal the musicians. But that brings me to and by the way, any good publisher will catch that. Bad publishers won't, and that's something to be very aware of if you're publishing poorly. So getting back to the readers in pop culture, you can't use all the lyrics, right? And Kitty listens to music and does from book one, okay? And she's getting musical clues and everything else. But I'm going to use an example from Touched by an Alien because it works for everything that's happening. Okay, up until this point, music she's listened to has made sense. And so she's got to jump out of a car and go run and try to save the day. And she's doing it while other people are arguing around her. And so she slips her earbuds in, and she turns it on to what she considers the best hard rock song ever, which is Metallica's Enter Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Enter Sandman tells you nothing about what this song is about. Okay, so Kitty, I have to have her in her inner dialogue, right? She's saying in the narrative, she's saying, I never realized that, you know, the song about how, you know, the Sandman was coming to kill you and there were evil monsters hiding in your bed was actually taken from fact, but there you go, right? So she's telling anybody who doesn't know who Metallica are and what that song's about, what it's about. So when we're fighting, there's lots of times where she'll be like, okay, in book 13, Camp Alien, there's a song that's on repeat, and this is when she already knows that she has someone giving her these clues. And if the song repeats, it's because she isn't getting something. Okay, and there are a couple of songs that repeat a lot in this book, and one of them is Victorious by Panic at the Disco. And this is at a point where they are not victorious. Okay, they're in a big battle, and she's repeating, she's like, okay, clearly I'm not getting it. Because a lot of times the title of the song is the clue, but in some cases, in this one, obviously, it's not. And so she realizes that there's the chorus is, we need to turn up the crazy. And she's like, oh, okay, that's what I need to do. So I can, for people who don't know what that is and why that's on her thing, you have to give them that clue. She makes a Dukes of Hazzard reference. Not everybody knows who that is, shockingly, but they don't. But she's talking about her car is flying through the air and she's whooping, right? You don't need to know what, you know, that this was good enough for the Duke boys and it's good enough for me, right? You don't need to watch the Dukes of Hazzard to get what she's referring about. So that's something you have to be aware of, is that not everybody knows what you're talking about. Some things aren't universal, okay? And when you get translated into other languages, some of your jokes aren't going to translate, and some of the references need a little bit more, so that you should do that. But I look at it, if you've done it with the assumption that somebody reading this will have no idea what you're talking about, and you give it should not be long, but an in-character, inappropriate description of why you solved the problem. You can still use the pop culture reference, and someone who is not aware of that particular aspect of the pop culture will still be able to understand what you're going for.
Okay. Kevin asks, how do you select the names of your characters?
How do I select them? Well, for Touched by an Alien, it was great because that was like I was taking dictation from Kitty in my head. So the names of the characters are the names they give me, including Kitty. She, I think it's chapter 2, she's just giving her name. It's Catherine Cat, K-A-T-T. And yes, before you ask, my parents called me Kitty. I stopped writing, turned away from the computer, and said, Kitty Cat, really, Kitty Cat? And she said, my parents have a sense of humor, keep writing. Okay. That was great for the first book, okay? And I'm kind of like that in every first book. And now I've realized that, number one, you can't do that as you go along. I have a cast of over 500 named characters. Oh, now, John is the most common name in the English language for men, but I can't have every 10th guy be named John because you can't keep it straight. I already have like 2 or 3, and it's really hard work to keep them straight. Okay, they're distinctly different, and they have different last names, so that helps. So I have to keep coming up with names, and then creating alien names is even harder. I don't remember which book it was that I was working on. Actually, I think it was one of the steampunk shorts, and I need names. And so I just tossed out a call on Facebook, kick me. You're not going to get credit because I'm not going to remember who gave it to me, but if you want your name to be, the name, you know, it has to sound alien, it has to sound like a planet or something. And I got some wonderful suggestions that I wrote down and saved and I refer to and using. So all those people, their names are getting in there. You know, I got a couple hundred and I'm using them up. So the thing I discovered, though, is that I have names that I would never have said, oh, well, that's going to be one of my favorite names in the world to use constantly, and yet I use them all the time. Some examples, Charles, Reynolds, Walter, James, Audrey, Randall, or Randolph, the Rands, right? Mm-hmm. And there are a few others that I'll stumble over and go, oh, my God. I have used that name in every first book of every series I've, like, ever written. You know, William, okay? There's a William, and there's a Bill, and there's a Billy. Oh, my God, right? It's a common name, though. And Robert and Bob, right? Okay, I think some of it is the names that you have, a variety of nicknames are great because you can use a variety of them. But these are not names that I would have normally told you, oh, well, you know, I'm going to have that. It's like, wow. So now I come up with the names by asking for help. most of them aren't the people themselves, it's the names they gave me as an idea to use. So yeah, but I'm very, very grateful. And sometimes it's like, okay, I need a whole bunch of supporting characters. We did one when I was writing one of the stories for the Alt Sherlock Holmes anthology, that which has been fun because I got to write Sherlock Holmes set in modern setting, and I made my Sherlock a woman and put them in her and Watson in modern day Los Angeles. Uh-huh. So that's fun to do. And I needed names, and so there was some really ridiculous game ad on Facebook that everything looked like a penis. I mean, everything. And it was like, okay, whoever finds the most that haven't been found, right, already gets to be in. So I got a whole bunch of names from that. I just took, if you guess found the right number of these things, you know, you found 50. Your name's in the story. But literally, that's how I did it. So it was kind of, it was a fun thing to do with fans. At the same time, gave me names for the story. So.
At Hamish Downey, I don't know if I said it right, but he asked, or she asked, which of your alien men is the sexiest?
Which of my alien names is the sexiest?
Alien men.
Oh, which of my alien men is the sexiest? Well, I think that has to go to Jeff Martini, because, you know, he's pretty much, you know, well, he's Kitty's, so that makes him important. I like most of them. I think it depends on what your type is. Considering I base everybody on utter hunks, that's, you know, helpful. In fact, if people want to see who I could envision playing the characters, if they go to my Pinterest page, I have a See the Characters page. So I think most romantic, hands down, would be Jeff. Jeff is extremely romantic. Which one you find the sexiest would be what you prefer as a type.
Right.
Because they're all covered. but I love all of them. So I vote Jeff. Other people will vote Christopher. Other people will vote Richard and Paul and Reader and Tim, who are humans and so forth. So I love all my boys.
Oh, that's very nice. It's good to know.
All my good boys. Yeah, all my good boys. I love all my good boys. My dogs just bounded in. We good boys, we good boys. Not you guys. I love you guys too. Okay.
Well, I still got a lot left, but I'll try to wrap up here with how about some future-looking ones? Is there this one's from Duncan. Is there any news to share on the Alexander Outland or Necropolis Enforcement Files series?
Oh, the inevitable, when the hell are you giving us the next book's question? They are getting my focus as soon as Aliens Like Us is turned in. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, I was toying with the idea of going to New York Comic Con this year, and I made the decision that I'm not going to do that because I need to really be focused on getting caught up. So digits crossed sooner than as opposed to later.
All
and
right.
I won't say anything. I've been promising next installments on things for far too long and failing to manage. So coming really soon. Okay. Sooner than it looks like they were coming last year.
And another related one from Keith. When can we expect a next visit to Happy Acres?
That was one of the ones I said was short that people are clamoring for.
Okay.
That's the sequel to the Happy Acres Haunted Hotel for Active Seniors. That one, it's funny, I remain awed with how much people liked that story. It was supposed to anchor an anthology that ended up changing its terms, so we pulled the story. And I was like, you know, I don't want to wait around. I really enjoy the story. I really enjoy the characters. I don't want to wait around for another anthology for this to fit into. I'm just going to self-publish it. And it's a novelette. And I remain happily shocked with how much people love it. And literally, everybody who was reading it, they're like, when's the next one? I'm like, this is a standalone. They're like, it can't be. There needs to be more. And so from enough people asking, I've actually, Maddie, the main character, has shared with me that there are other stories, but she knows I'm stressed, and she knows I'm behind, and she'll let me know when the story's ready for me to write it. So it'll be coming, but I don't know when. Got to get caught up on all those other things.
Let's see. There's still quite a few left. Maybe we can.
Oh, let's go for them. Okay. Let's go for them. I'll try to answer shorter.
Let's see. Lloyd, he asks, from a feminist standpoint, what would you say is the difference between writing a female character and writing a character who happens to be female? Can you think of examples for each?
I think I know what he means. Writing a female character versus writing a character who happens to be female. The character who happens to be female, I think the really great example is from the movie Salt. I don't know that this was a big hit, but it's basically a spy movie, and it was originally supposed to star Tom Cruise. He had to drop out from conflicts, and they changed the role to be Angelina Jolie.
Okay,
so they changed it from a man to a woman pretty seamlessly. It's just the character happens to be a woman.
Mm-hmm.
She's doing all the same things. They gender flip her and they gender flip the spouse. Okay, so now she's got a husband instead of a wife and so forth.
Right.
Basically, if your character isn't going to be doing something that I would say is extremely gender specific,
mm-hmm.
That would make it, well, only a man could do this, only a woman could do that. It's writing a really good character, and you can just decide if it's a man or a woman. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
What suits your story best?
Okay.
In the case of like the Alien series, it would be a completely different series if Kitty was Keith, for example.
Right.
It would be very, very different. I don't think it would be as fun. I don't think I would have enjoyed writing it in the same way. And by the same token, Alexander Outland, Space Pirate, would be a completely different book if it was a female in that role. That needed to be a man from a man's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Kitty needs to be a woman from a woman's perspective. But there are some where it's like, yeah, I could make that a man or a woman. I made it a woman because. Okay, in The Legend of Belladonna, Belle has to be a woman because part of the point I'm making is what the world has done to her because she is a woman who was basically helpless as a child. Because she was a girl, okay, what that's turned her into because of the things that have happened, and she's a very different person than a boy would have been in that same situation.
Right.
So some of them really, really matter. So I think it depends on what you as the author are trying to say, and then what you and the author want to do. And like I said, Assault to me is a really great example of how you just casually gender flip it and it's fine. Way back, I just had the title and I blanked on it, but Rebecca De Mornay and Don Johnson starred in Guilty as Sin, starred in this movie, and it was a complete gender flip. She's the strong lawyer, and you see her, the love scene with her boyfriend, mm-hmm. She's in a shirt, he's naked. Okay,
yeah,
it's a
wow.
complete
yeah,
flip, intentionally done, right. intentionally right. done by the screenwriters and everybody. But she has to be a woman in that. It has to be a woman based on Don Johnson's villain. Okay. It requires a woman to be the strong adversary. Okay, a man, it would not have worked right. Okay, so that's one where they did the gender flop, but they did the gender switch intentionally and because it needs to be a woman that's the hero. Otherwise, I have not seen it. Okay, and I'm in no way saying that she is as good an actor as he is, but my impression from watching the trailers for Skyscraper, starring I love and adore Dwayne Johnson, okay, I think you could have put Ronda Rousey in the role and have it work.
Interesting. Yeah.
Okay, now I don't think Ronda really needs some acting classes, okay, before she could do that. But you take a big buff woman, and I could buy it just as well. Okay, it's really. That to me is something that you could gender flip easily, okay? Because I'm sorry, I think if you're a returning vet and you've lost a limb, I think for women and men it's still a lot. There's a lot of similarities. It's still a difficult thing, and all these other things. You can still be brave, even though you have a disability and so forth. So I think that you could write the role could just be a woman as well as a man. So I think it's possibly easier to flip it in action, but not as a genre, but not all the time. You know, my New West series, I could flip Josie and Deacon, but I didn't want to, and I think it works better the way they are, again, because of the statements I'm making in there that, you know, are subtly hidden. Victoria from Necropolis Enforcement Files in the Nightbeat. Yeah, Vic could probably be a man. Vic could have been Victor, and we could have flipped it around. The character is female as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, I mean, I think some of it is just what do you feel like? What is the story what's the story that's telling you? And which way do you want it to go? But there are stories that are distinctly should be told from a male or female or trans or whatever perspective, and those stories should be from that story, that POV. Mm-hmm. And there are other stories where it really doesn't matter. Just do whatever's working for you.
And Paul asks, I think he's referring to your first draft. When you're doing your first pass, do you put in chapter headings as you go, or do you just make a notation in the document where a chapter break will go?
I put in the chapters. I write in a thriller style, and that was learned, and it's one of those things I'm really happy I learned. So a thriller style is short chapters, cliffhanger endings, okay, that make you keep turning the pages, which I heartily recommend. There's some genres it doesn't work as well, but in most of what I write, that really is the right way to go. And I put the chapter breaks in because I think it's ridiculous to go back and say, well, I noted where a chapter break, but the frickin' chapter 20 page break, what does it back up if it's wrong? Okay. I think anything you do that requires you to do needless extra steps is not your brightest choice.
Okay.
So something like that, I'm going to ticky mark it. No, just put the chapter. My God, there's a search function in every word processing program. It's just not that hard. I do this all the time. I'll put chapter in the search, and then I'll go 1, 2, 3. Oh, I have six chapter 16s. Better fix that. Oh, I missed chapter 27. I go from 26 to 28. Need to fix that. This is not a big deal. That's any formatting stuff you should be doing as you're going. Mm-hmm. Not making notations, you know. You need to make notations, big ones, if it's like, you know, I'm inserting something here, or I need to come up with a name, or dramatic fights, dramatic soliloquy that I haven't come up with yet, you know, big fight scene. You need to make those big and large so that you don't turn it in with just those words. but really, anything that is going to require you to go back through and do something very basic, you shouldn't do. And I did stuff like this, not the chapter thing so much, but I used to prefer to write in 10-point font. My eyes were a lot better then. Now I'd really like to write in 16-point font, but that would be stupid because here's the reason why. Okay, you should be writing in format, and format is, you know, the inch margins on either side. There are no double returns after your paragraph is indented 5 spaces and is done by tabbing, not by going tap, 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 tap on the space bar. It should be 12-point Times Roman. Nobody likes Courier anymore unless the market specifically requests it. Most people would prefer to look at Times New Roman.
Okay.
For all of you people out there who are like, oh, but I'm going to spend all my effort on formatting, format to spec. Okay. Do not underline unless you italicize the italicized words. People are using really outdated stuff that existed in the days of old-fashioned typesetting that has gone the way of the dinosaur. So you don't hit the return twice after a period either. That went out for those keeping score at home in the late 80s, early 90s.
Uh-huh.
Stop doing it. Because what you do is now every frickin' copy editor has to go back and fix it because you have inserted a space they don't need. Okay, one space after a period. We aren't using ancient typesetting equipment anymore. That's the only reason that existed.
Right.
Okay. Some of these things, the only reason you used Courier was because it's set up exactly like the typesetting equipment of the day. You had to underline instead of italicize because Courier doesn't really italicize well. And that way they would know it was supposed to be italicized. None of that matters anymore
right,
today.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the space after the period has been gone for longer than don't use Courier as anymore. So from a formatting issue, there's lots of stuff out there, but you need to be looking, if you're looking at formatting books, it better be something that was revised in the last 2 years or came out in the last 2 years, because otherwise you are setting yourself up for ancient stuff that somebody is going to say, why did you send it to me like this?
Right.
Okay, and it's basic format. There's a variety of reasons to write, just start writing in proper format. Okay. I start with the title page with my name and return address and all my email stuff, the title page and my agent's information under the title on everything.
Okay.
On everything. Why? Because then I don't have to go back and add it in, which is a hassle and a half. I just start it that way, every document, whether I think I'm going to sell it or self-publish it. Okay. Everyone. If I'm self-publishing, it's really easy to hit delete. It's not as easy to add in documents. Delete is far easier. So the reason you want to be doing it in format is that you, especially there are still agents and editors out there who want your manuscript or your short story in physical format. Yes, they're less and less, but they're still out there because they want to be able to mark it up in pen.
Right.
Okay? Because
right.
It's their process. Okay? You want to be in format because if you have a widow or an orphan, and I'm going to make y'all look up what a widow and an orphan are in terms of publishing, so you'll remember it better, you will need to do something to fix that before you're printing it out, or worse, you send it to them and they have to print it out, and you've burned a whole piece of their paper.
Right.
Okay? It sounds like no big. Except if you're doing that every single chapter and you've got a long book, that's enough reason for me to never want to deal with you.
Right.
Okay, they're all looking for reasons to say no. Don't let your formatting and your setup be the reason they say no. If you send in something, if someone asks for standard formatting and you've decided, well, Ginny Koch doesn't know what she's talking about, I'm going to write it in 10-point and I'm going to do a double return and I'm going to indent, I'm going to do business style because I think that looks better, they won't read it. You're done. They'll take one look and go, this person has no clue, and you're in the trash or you're returned. If
right.
You're
I think that's their default okay. position. Your stuff is in the trash already once they get it, and you have to give them a reason to take it out of the trash.
Pretty much. I mean, they're trying to be nice, okay,
yeah.
But they see so much crap
right.
that if you give them even the slightest reason for them to go, ugh, forget it, they're
mm-hmm.
done.
Right.
Okay, and your formatting, if you can't spell, that's all on you. Well, there's editors. Yeah, and you should have used one. Okay? I will tell you, if you're not formatted right and or your first page is loaded with misspellings, poor grammar, syntax, word usage, or punctuation, you're done. Mm-hmm. You're not worth the time. It doesn't even matter what you wrote. You're not worth the time to fix because you apparently are such a prima donna. You're either too stupid to have figured out what the rules are, or you're a prima donna that's going to be hell to work with. And here's the other little secret. There are a million look just like you, have a story similar to yours, but did the formatting, the spelling, the punctuation, and everything else, and one of them's going to get the contract you might have gotten had you put forth the effort.
Right. And it would be an awful shame to do all that work and then to fail at that point because you weren't
happens
willing
all
to
the time.
The
happens
polish, put the polish on.
Every agent, every editor, daily gets this. Not just one. Tons. Okay? People don't treat this like the profession it is. This is a business. And people that don't treat it like a business don't succeed in it because business exists to make money and make money, and that's the only reason business exists. It's not to support our hopes and dreams. It's not to say your genius spread to the world. It's to make money. They'll buy your book if they think they can sell it, and if they don't think they can sell it, it could be the most brilliant thing ever written. They ain't going to buy it. Okay, can they be wrong? Sure. Okay, but they're not wrong if you couldn't be bothered to spell and punctuate properly. And if it is intentional, I'm writing in dialect. Mark Twain did it. First of all, I want you to pause for a minute and take a good long look in the mirror and realize you aren't Mark Twain and you're never going to be, number one. Number two, dialect is extremely hard to pull off. I've written one short story in it, and it's just, it fit the story, and I felt no great desire to do it again, okay? Too much is way too much, okay, on dialect, and your market's become incredibly limited, okay? So it's not an excuse, but I would tell you if you've got the most brilliant book and you everything is punctuated or you've done all the other things in your cover letter, you had better say, this is, you will see, this is written in dialect. Mm-hmm. This is intentionally written in dialect. The misspellings you may see are intentional, okay? But if it's just that you couldn't be bothered and you say that, you're worse than dump because they'll share their special favorite of this week with each other or this month, okay? Right. You never want to be that person. Right. Okay, but so if you are writing something in dialect and it actually is good and people can read it without wanting to claw their eyes out or shoot themselves in the head, in your cover letter, you'd better make sure you make a point of saying you're writing in dialect. To give yourself a shot that they'll get, keep reading. Because otherwise you've given them a reason to say, oh, no. So, dialect very hard. No, there. None of us are Twain.
No.
So, don't think you are, because you're not. You know, no one's really writing the Great American Novel. You think you are. You know how you know when you've written the Great American Novel? When the reading public decrees it's the Great American Novel. Not when you decree it.
Fair enough.
When
I think some people have.
Reading public decrees it.
Yeah.
Okay. So you aren't Harper Lee. And as we've discovered, even Harper Lee wasn't really Harper Lee, which was, you know, the sadness discovery. But yeah, you're not. So disabuse yourself of that notion. You'll actually write a lot better.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed our conversation.
Question. Do we have any more?
Well, there's a few more from several people we've already covered.
Okay.
Strain your time.
fine. If we have more questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Okay. Let's see. Mark asked, "How are the penguins doing?"
They're great. I'm not sure which penguins he's asking about, so we're just going to say they're great.
Okay.
One of the characters. Kitty refers to how he looks at the Earth as it's like he's a penguin observer.
Oh.
You know, you get attached to the penguins, but you're not really interacting with the penguins. So penguins have become a big thing, therefore, in the fan base. So penguins are great.
Okay. And he also mentions that you were involved with a Kickstarter campaign and he wondered, I guess it was titled Guilds and Glaives.
Oh,
and,
okay.
What was your experience with that?
Oh, well, that's not the only Kickstarter. A lot of anthologies today are going the Kickstarter route, which is great because traditional publishers don't find that they make a lot of money, but traditional small presses are doing really well with them. And two of those, one is Zombies Needs Brains, and one is UFO Press, which they do the Unidentified Funny Objects books and others. And I really love working for both of those publishers. Writing for them is great. Really good editing, really good support, good payment for authors, timely, everything else. Very good, very well-run Kickstarters, prizes turned out right when they're supposed to be. So Guilds and Glaives, I wrote a story as Anita Ensol in that. And actually, it's funny. So now I know exactly who Mark is because he asked this question related to that. So now I know which Mark out of the fan base this is. We had to obviously write something about set in a guild, a glaive, a fantasy, an epic fantasy setting, right? Mm-hmm. And I wanted to write about assassins, and I was just sort of like, eh. And we do things called Tuckerizations. Tuckerizations, for those that don't know, was started by a man whose last name was Tucker. I don't remember his first name. He was an author, and he used to put his friends' names in the books. And usually they'd be, you know, like a red shirt character, you know, the first person killed, or you know, the paramour of somebody minor, you know, that gets a little stage presence, that kind of thing. And then ended up being, you wanted to be Tuckerized, okay? Yeah. Well, these days, in order to help fund Kickstarters, a lot of us will offer Tuckerizations in our stories. So you get to have your name or the name you're choosing to have put in the stories. So Mark was one of the people that Tuckerized in this story, and Mark's last name happens to be Slaughter. And yeah. I was really stuck until he Tuckerized. And then I'm like, oh, I have my entire story. And the story in Guilds and Glaives is the three assassins of Lord Slaughter. So that's that for me. That's one of the things about short stories that's really key, is that I need that correct title. Mm-hmm. I need that little spark of, oh my gosh, this is the story. I've been playing around with how you like, oh, this has already happened, and now what are these three assassins doing? And I'm like, wait a minute, the thing that's already happened, that's the story. So between that and Mark's name, we came up with it. I really enjoyed it. That was very fun. UFO 7, in a related way, that Kickstarter, we actually did it backwards for that, for this particular book. We've all already written, turned in our stories and been paid, and now we're waiting for the Kickstarter to hopefully fund the publisher, right? And so I had to come up with something, and this time I don't have anybody's names to use because we haven't Tuckerized yet. We haven't done the Kickstarter.
Oh, okay.
And I just had nothing, okay? The editor did not want something in series this time, so he didn't want Alien series, Steampunk series, Necropolis of Art. He didn't want anything. He's had one from all of these, right? And he wants something standalone, like your first story you did for me in UFO 3. And I don't know. And the only thing I write down is my story title ideas and story ideas, right? I write those down that aren't part of a series. So I have, like, more ideas than I'll ever get to write. I've started combining them, okay? And so I go through the whole thing, and it doesn't work, and I go through everything I've got on my computer, and I've got nothing, and I'm going through again. And I see this one story that I was going to write as a novel for J.C. Koch. And I've only written short stories in horror so far, right? Mm-hmm. And the title was The Vampire's Apprentice. And I looked at it and I said, I have nothing on this story other than some vague idea that I want to do this. What if I do that and do it really funny? And so I did it in an epistolatory style, which is how Dracula was written.
Right.
And I just love it. And the editor loves it. The copy editor over there, she's like, this is my favorite of anything you've ever done. I'm like, oh, thank you. So sometimes it just comes from different ways. But yeah, so Guilds and Glaives is out now. as is second round, A Return to the Urbar, where I have, writing as A.E. Stanton, a lawman, an outlaw, and a gambler walk into a bar. So those are both very fun. And it was fun to get to write something from as Anita Enthal and A.E. Stanton, as opposed to having to do it as Ginny, so I didn't have to make those two funny. Vampire's Apprentice is by me as Ginny. So, Ginny Koch writing. Yeah, so UFO 7's Kickstarter is going to start. It'll be running by when this airs. So if y'all would go on to Kickstarter and please support UFO 7 from Unidentified Funny Object 7 from UFO Press, that would be awesome. And if you're looking for some really, all of the Zombie Needs Brains anthologies are really cool. So they've got a bunch. It's not just Skills and Glaze and Second Round, and I'm in most of them. Not all, but most. And they're all really good. So I can't say enough good things both about the publishers themselves and their editing and the whole process with them, and how good their product is.
Oh, great. The last ones, there are several from Kevin, like a lightning round here. So where do you get your inspiration from?
Rock and roll, pictures of good-looking leading men, pretty much that's 90%. Anthology descriptions otherwise, yeah.
Okay. I like this one. If you could tell your younger writing self anything, what would it be?
Oh, I would tell 15-year-old me that teacher was, in fact, an idiot, and you don't need to outline.
Okay.
Keep all those ideas, and the moment you get a personal computer, start writing.
Okay. How many unpublished and half-finished books do you have? Sounds like a lot, I think, in your head.
Oh, my dear God. hang on. I'm unpublished. We have 1, 2, 3, 4. Between 4 and 6, we're still shopping, that are completed novels that I really want to launch a series. Started and not finished, triple digits, easy.
Okay.
I'll start writing, and once I'm at a stop point, I'll move on, and if it doesn't work for me, I'll just keep moving on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll come back to it, and maybe I'll finish it up. Like Vampire's Apprentice, I had a title, okay? And now I have a successful short story, so, yeah.
Oh, great. I'll have to read that one.
Yeah. I hope so.
Two more from him. What kind of research do you do, and how long do you spend researching before beginning a book?
Researching before beginning, it depends on the book. There's one that I'm in the middle of that's requiring and it's not moving along very fast. It requires a tremendous amount of research, and it's just I can't give that time to something that isn't contracted. For Kitty, it depends on the book. For like the Necropolis Enforcement File series, I don't have to do a lot of research. So almost nothing when I'm starting. My research is rereading the prior stuff. For the Alien series, it depends on what we're doing and where we're going and where we're starting, so there's almost always some. And a lot of times, like I was saying earlier, you know, I had to research the name of that cap. Okay, I didn't realize I was going to have to do that until I got to the part where I was writing and going, I don't know what that's called.
Okay.
And I can't say the cap that an enlisted Marine would wear as his dress cap, because that's just ridiculously long when it has a name.
Right.
So, yeah, the research hits you, and you spend, there's two answers. You spend as long as you need on research. That's the official, I am such an effective time manager. The moment you have your answer, you're done. Or what most of us unfortunately do is, wow, this is so interesting, and you end up researching a whole lot. It can be very worthwhile. However, I had to do book two has a lot of Alien Tango has a lot of action at the Kennedy Space Center, and I had never been there, so I had to do a lot of research on their site. And while I'm looking at it, I discover they have an alligator preserve in the Space Center grounds, and they're really proud of it.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, okay, that's great, right? Okay.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, okay, right. I'm writing, and Kitty has an idea, and alligators are in the story because I read that. So research can really take you a lot of places. So, you know, sometimes even if you're down the rabbit hole, it'll help you later on. But I try to limit it because I could spend 3 hours researching and then I haven't written anything.
And his last question is, do you hide any secrets in your books that only a few people will find?
Oh, do I hide secrets in the books? Well, there are always clues about what's coming in the Alien series if you're paying attention, which is why rereading is rewarded, especially if you're rereading the series and when you get to the book, it's like, that's what that was. I've dropped little hints and clues and things. Most of the private jokes that are in there, if there are any, are for me and my critique partner, Lisa DeVicke. If there's a joke, you know, like Anita Ensel is a private joke between me and Phyllis. There's some other jokes in there between me and Lisa. You know, maybe. It's hard for me to think of. There's, you know, if it's your name, it could be you. It could just be I like the name.
Right.
You know, unless you were Tucker Rice, and then it's definitely you. Well, it's the name you gave me. It's not necessarily you, you know. But, yeah, probably. It's just that most of them are going to be for Lisa, or if they're in the Alien series, they're for you if you're really alert.
Okay.
So.
Well, thank you for being to be and your
Oh, readers. You're very welcome. Well, thank you so much. I'm very excited, and this was very fun.
How will people find you if they've just heard you for the first time?
Okay. I am on many, many, much social media. My website is www.ginikoch.com. I'm on Facebook. I have my regular page, Facebook fan page, which is Ginny Koch Hairspray and Rock and Roll. Ginny Koch, author of the Alien Catherine Kitty Cat series, Ginny Koch, which I had to grab because Facebook popped it up for me. So now I have 3 Facebook fan pages. Yay. Because that's not hard to maintain or anything. I'm at Twitter at Ginny Koch, capital G, capital K, no dot. There is another Ginny Koch with an underscore in there. She is very cool. She's German. And you could actually mistake us because we like a lot of the same things. She happens to be fluent. She is, unlike me, I'm fluent in English and sarcasm. She's fluent in English and German and probably other languages. The easiest way to tell is I have one of my book covers as an avatar. That changes, but it's always there. But she is very nice, and if you actually get her and she can realize that you're trying to find me, she'll flip you over to me and vice versa. So,
oh, very nice.
I'm on Pinterest, like I said, Ginny Koch, and that like I said, you've got lots of cool pictures up there. My covers, things I like, things I think are funny, and then the see the characters. So I think that's, if you want into the visuals, that's a great place to go. And I supposedly have an Instagram. However, I don't know how to make it work. I got on it, and people were like, yay, and I managed to post one thing, and I couldn't post anything else, and it was just like, yeah, I'm not looking over there. One day someone will help me redo that, but at this point, stick with the basics of Facebook, Twitter. Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and then there's a Facebook fan page, the Alien Collective Virtual HQ. If you go to my website and you want my newsletter, that's the Hook Me Up newsletter, and it's free. Details for how to join are at the bottom of most of the pages of my website, and it's also up there on the Facebook Hairspray and Rock and Roll site, so you can join the newsletter. There's probably something
I'll
else
have you
forgetting,
back to
but
discuss
that's
all that stuff. So.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. My career before being a full-time author was in marketing and advertising. So I was a social media maven before it was cool.
I love you. I definitely want you back for that. Okay. Well, thank you so much. I enjoyed our conversation.
Well, thank you. I did too, and it was really great being here.